Very new. I mean, think about it. When they left Galilee, they didn't tell their wives and children, we're off to die. They said, we're going to go kick the Romans out of Jerusalem because Jesus is the Messiah and I'm going to bring him glory and money and honor and power. In fact, I'll send for you and you'll come to Jerusalem and live with us. They didn't say we're going to die. These are men with families. And so they're probably thinking here, what's going to happen? What about my wife? What about my kids? Is this why I left everything? If Jesus is going to die and I've just vowed to stay with him, does that mean I'm dying too? And so again, their minds must be reeling with this new information. And so it must have been a relief to follow Jesus into this familiar garden. There they'll be able to rest. Now Jesus knows them well, and you'll see in verse 32 that he tells them, sit here while I pray. Now Luke adds, in his account of this event in chapter 22, verse 40, he adds to this, Jesus also instructed them that they should pray that they not enter into temptation. Now just go back to the conversation they've just had. Jesus said to them, you're all going to fall away. Each one of them said, no, I won't. Jesus left that no, I won't hanging. I think he left it hanging because this is the response that he wants to give them. Pray that you don't fall. Pray that you don't fall away. Don't tell me what you're going to do. Pray that you do what you must. I know you. I know you don't want to die. I know you're afraid. I know you can't not fall away. And so you need to pray that you don't. Remember how we were talking about last week that the disciples are in this mode of religion in which for them the vow not to do is what matters. It's we refer to the religion of achievement, the I can do it religion. And so when Jesus says you're all going to fall away, their response is not help me. Their response is, oh no, I'm not. I'm not falling away because they have this religion of self-achievement. I can do it. And prayer in the context of that kind of religion is just one more thing you do for God. Jesus' gospel, however, is God can do it. You can't. You can't. To pray here, as Jesus is instructing them to do, and as Jesus has taught them throughout his ministry, is to acknowledge your weakness, to acknowledge your vulnerability, to acknowledge that, in fact, you cannot do it, that you need his help. And so they've given him a vow not to fall away, and he's given them the real remedy. What you really must do to have strength here, guys, is pray, not vow. Instead of telling them what you're going to do, let God see yourself. Let God see everything. Let him see who you are and give you strength to stand. And that's important for you too when you pray. I do think sometimes, especially Anglicans, because we do have these set prayers, the prayer can sometimes be for Anglicans a kind of thing that you give to God to make him happy because he wants you to pray. It's this thing that I offer to him. That's not what prayer is for the Christian. For the Christian, the prayer is something that you do because you must do it, because you need it, because you have to have it. And so you go before him and you don't hide anything. You don't say, God, this is who I am and this is what I'm going to do for you. You go to him and you let him see your complaints. You let him see your flaws. You let him see your weaknesses. You let him see your anger. You let him see your temptations. I don't care how dark and disgusting they are. You let him see all of that stuff. And then you say, help me. My God, help me. I can't clothe myself. I need you to clothe me. I can't be strong. I need you to strengthen me. Christian prayer is really the gospel acted out. Acknowledging that you do not have what it takes and that God does. Now, I want you to note here something very interesting, because Jesus not only calls his disciples to pray, he also prays. Jesus is the perfect man. As human beings go, he lacks nothing. He is sinless. He is sinless. But here Jesus, the sinless, perfect man, has come to pray. Now, Christianity for many, and you probably heard this if you've talked to somebody about the faith, Christianity for many who reject it is considered a crutch for the weak. I don't need Jesus because I'm fine. I have everything I need. I'm a strong person. I don't need that religious stuff. And the response from you and from me to people who say that should be, yes, Christianity is for the weak. And so if you don't think you're weak, then yes, Christianity will not be for you. Of course, the problem is, as Jesus tells us, is that everyone really is weak. Everyone really is weak. They just don't know it. Here, Jesus, because he's a human being, though he is perfect, acknowledges that he is utterly dependent on his Father. Think about Adam and Eve in the garden. Before sin came, they were designed to be utterly dependent on the Father. Sin came when they decided to be independent of the Father. Here, Jesus, the perfect man, is setting himself down and depending on his Father, as we all should. Now, let me just ask you before we go on, what would you be doing right now if you were Jesus? I mean, you have maybe an hour or so before your arrest, before your trial before the Jews, before your trial before the Romans, before your crucifixion, which will be very painful. You have very little time. Lots of things are going on. What would you be doing? Now, I haven't asked her this, but I guess that if I would ask her this, I can tell you what Anne would be doing. She'd be rearranging her kitchen cabinets or something. Find some busy thing to do. And I would probably be, if I were in Jesus' place right now, I'd probably be working out exactly what my defense strategy would be for the trial, so that I would know exactly what to say when I got up there before the Sanhedrin or before Pilate. You know, because when we get really pressured and stressed, what do you do? Well, it's very interesting. At the height of Jesus' anxiety and pressure and stress, the culmination of everything that he's worked for, he, instead of doing anything else, says, I've got to pray. I need my Father. Jesus prays. Now look at verse 33. He takes with him Peter and James and John. Now, they are the inner circle, and so Jesus does often take them aside to give them little leadership lessons and that sort of thing. But I think there's something more here, because out of the 11, these three guys are the biggest boasters, the greatest braggarts. Think about Peter. You've already seen Peter. He's already said, Jesus, I'm not going to deny you. Jesus says, yes, you are. Peter says, no, I'm not. But what about James and John? What happened in Mark chapter 10 on the way to Jerusalem? Did anyone remember? They get their mama, and they go to Jesus, and their mama actually asks, but in Mark, you just see James and John ask, but they ask, you know, and actually, it's not even an ask. If you look at the language, it's a demand. We want thrones on your right hand and on your left-hand side. And if you remember, Jesus said, well, you know, it's not for me to give, but are you able to drink from the cup from which I will drink? Who remembers the answer? Yes, we are. We are able to drink from the cup from which you will drink. Amazing arrogance. So of the 11, these three guys are the proudest, the biggest boasters. And Jesus takes them aside. And what does he show them? What does he show them? Verse 33. He began to be greatly distressed and troubled. He shows them weakness. Now, the word for distressed is, well, that's understated. You often find that in the New Testament translations. Distressed is understated. It's more like surprised by fear. That's the idea there. So when I beat Ife in basketball and he had to stop me by tripping me and cutting my Achilles tendon, and I had to get an operation, when that happened, I was told immediately by the doctor in the emergency room, you're going to have surgery to have this fixed because you won't walk if you don't. So they scheduled the surgery about a month away from my injury, and I thought, oh, okay, yeah, no problem. And they told me I was going to have to go under anesthesia, and I just kind of contemplated it from afar. That'd be kind of fun. I get to take a day off from work, and then I'll be having the recovery time, and I'll just be able to lay around and have Ann give me stuff, and it'll be a good time. But as the time progressed toward the actual surgery, something started to happen. I started to become more and more afraid, especially after I read an article about anesthesia and what happens or what could happen when you're put under. And so the night before my surgery, I was really freaking out. I wouldn't tell Ann that, but I was very afraid of what was going to happen the next day. So that's kind of what happens here. Jesus has been contemplating the coming of the crucifixion for 3 years, probably longer. But now it's here. And the reality of it, I think, begins to weigh down on him. You might, in a more serious note, have experienced this if you've ever been with somebody who's been given a terminal diagnosis. And they might know months off, I'm going to die. But having been a pastor for several people like that, when the time comes, whether they're Christian or not, when it draws near, there's a fear there, a real fear that they didn't know would be there. That's kind of what we're seeing here. The word troubled is also understated. It sounds like he's a little perturbed, but no, the word is more white-knuckled fear. He's really afraid. Now, I think American Christians have a hard time with this text. A woman I know is diagnosed with cancer. She's okay. She made it out of it, but it didn't look like she would be when the diagnosis came down. She was diagnosed with cancer. She was terrified. At this point, she was going to a different church, and her brothers and sisters rallied around her and prayed for her and were good with her for the first few weeks, but then she didn't cheer up. Like, she continued being depressed and worried and afraid, even when people prayed for her. And so people started to react to that. And out came the coffee cup verses. You know the coffee cup verses? Count it all joy, my brethren, when you face many trials and tribulations, or trials and tribulations of many kind. From James chapter 1. Or perfect love cast out fear. Or rejoice, says Paul. I say it again, rejoice. See, many have thought that faith in Jesus, and they've been taught this, results in happiness. And so, if someone is not happy, there must be something wrong with their faith. If they're not able to have peace in all circumstances, something must be wrong. Because the Christian casts her anxiety upon the Lord and is kept in perfect peace, right? So why are you still upset about your cancer diagnosis? Worry, after all, is a sin, right? Jesus says, don't worry. You better stop worrying. How are you guys doing today? Is it working? But here's Jesus. Here is Jesus. Fear, trembling, unspeakable anxiety. Where is the joy, joy, joy down deep in his heart? What's wrong with him? Does he not have sufficient faith? Is he not? Well, why is he like this? What's going on with him? Well, here's the problem. I think that we as Americans read the Bible emotively. So we read Paul say, or command, rejoice, and we think he means feel happy. We read James say, count it all joy, and we think he means feel joyful. We read John say, perfect love casts out fear. And I think to myself, well, if I really loved perfectly, then I wouldn't be afraid of anything. I wouldn't feel any fear. Jesus says, commands, don't worry. And we think that he means I mustn't feel worry. No. No Jew would have read it that way. That's a very American way of reading your Bible. God does not say to the mourner, don't feel sad. And he doesn't say to the frightened, don't have any feeling of fear. And he doesn't say to the person who's worried or anxious, you can't feel that way. What he says is, don't let these things rule you and override you. That's what these commands mean. What he's saying is, I'm greater than anything you're afraid of. I'm greater than any of your worries. I'm greater than any of your sorrows. And so come to me, lay down your burdens with me. I'll share them with you. That's all he means. Because if you don't think that, what you're going to do is you're going to sit there and pile on top of your head guilt for feeling the way that you think the Bible has said you shouldn't feel, and on top of not, you know, being a sinner in general. So you're going to feel guilt and mourning at the same time, guilt and fright at the same time, guilt and anxiety at the same time. Don't do that. Jesus doesn't seek that. Jesus always wants you to come to him, and it's okay if you're not okay. I would hate to be a church where we have to walk around like this. How are you doing? Oh, I'm just loving life, enjoying the Lord. No, you're not. And I'm not either. I mean, life is hard. I love this passage because we see humanity, perfect humanity, perfect, sinless humanity in the depths of sorrow, fear, and anxiety. And he's not doing anything wrong. He's not doing anything wrong. Fake TV preachers promise a shiny life with perfect teeth. They have nothing to say here. Nothing. Jesus promises you himself, and he is a man of sorrows acquainted with grief, which is a good thing because so are we. It's a great thing. So Jesus says, or Jesus is distressed and troubled. Verse 34, my soul is very sorrowful even to death. The word very sorrowful, or the phrase very sorrowful, is from one word, perilupos. Peri means encompassed. Jesus is here saying, my whole being is encompassed by sorrow. There's not a part of me that doesn't feel this sorrow. And then he says to the point of death, and we might think that he's exaggerating or being hyperbolic, but what is he doing according to Luke? He's about to be sweating blood. The sorrow is so real and painful that it actually becomes a physical thing, a life-threatening thing. And then Jesus says out loud to Peter, James, and John, or Jesus says this out loud to Peter, James, and John, men who boast of their fidelity, men who boast of their strength, men who boast of their worthiness. Jesus says to these guys, I'm encompassed by sorrow. So these guys are boasting to Jesus of their strength. Jesus takes them aside, lets them see him come apart, and then boasts of his weakness. And then he says, he gives them a command, remain and watch. Remain and watch. And that's going to be important as we go on. So let's do go on. Verse 35, going a little further, Luke tells us it's a stone's throw, which would be within hearing distance and within seeing distance. Jesus fell on the ground. Now, the customary way to pray for Jews in the first century was like this. Now, that wasn't being necessarily arrogant. That's just the way they did it. Same way we bow our heads and close our eyes, they did it that way. But here Jesus falls. He falls. He does the opposite. And the reason he falls is because he's weak. Because he's at the end of himself. He has no strength left. And so he prays. Verse 35, we're told the disciples, or the three heard him pray about, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. Do notice here that Jesus prays for himself. Every once in a while, I'll have a Christian come into me and I'll ask them about their prayer life, and they'll say, "Oh, I pray every day." And I'll say, "Okay, well, how do you pray?" And they'll say something like, "Oh, I pray for others so much that I hardly have time to pray for myself." And I want to say, "Well, you're foolish. You're stupid." I'm sorry, I shouldn't use that. But you're being stupid and you're being foolish, because look, Jesus prays for himself. And you can imagine that every time that he's gone apart by himself to pray, that this has been part of it. "Oh, Father, help me. Give me your strength. Help me." If you think you don't need to pray for yourself, then you're stronger than Jesus. I don't think that is anyone here. Jesus prays for himself. Now look what he prays in verse 36. "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me." Now the word Abba is not Hebrew. It's not Greek. It's Aramaic. It's the language that most people normally spoke, and the apostles here preserved it. The word is a little bit like mama. You know how mama is easy to say, so babies usually say mama first, not because they like her better, but just because it's easier to say. Well, the same thing went on in the first century for Jews, that most Jewish babies would say Abba first, because it's easy to do. And it was a very intimate term. You've probably heard before that it's equivalent to our daddy, and yes, it is. It's the father-son, father-daughter kind of word that you would use. But you would never, ever use it in public to address your father. You would never, for a Jew, you would never say to your father, "Daddy." You would always say, "Father." It would be weird to do the daddy thing in public. It was too familiar, too intimate. And in the same way, you would never use this word Abba, no Jew ever did, for God. You would never address him as Abba. You may call him Father because he's the Father of Israel, but you would never go this intimately. That would be considered highly irreverent for Jews. And so I think the disciples, or the three who hear him do that, are so shocked they preserve that word, that Aramaic word. And this is very important for us, because what we're given here is a huge, great privilege. A veil has been moved for you and for me. We're being given access and insight into the intimacy between Father and Son that has existed before all worlds. This word Abba is really important for us understanding the relationship, the love relationship between Father and Son. This is the koinonia that has always existed between them. And what's unique about seeing it here is that before God became man in Jesus, no human being ever enjoyed this level of intimacy with Yahweh. But now Jesus, the man, united with God the Son as one person, is brought into the koinonia of God. Now, the reason I'm spending some time on this is because of what Paul tells you in Galatians chapter 4, verse 6. He says this: because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into your hearts, crying, "Abba, Father." You see what that text is saying? It's saying that this deeply intimate, eternal relationship between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit that Jesus has been brought into by virtue of the incarnation is also yours, by virtue of being in Christ. It's a beautiful thing. All right.
I'm sorry, what
was that? That's Galatians 4, 6. Verse 36. In this prayer, Jesus says, "All things are possible with you." Now, if you remember back in Mark chapter 10, the disciples asked after a wealthy young ruler who was very devout came to Jesus and left when Jesus said to give away everything. The disciples asked him, hey, if this wealthy, law-abiding, good man cannot be saved, who can? Who remembers what Jesus said as a response to that? With man, it's impossible. You cannot be saved men cannot be saved in their own strength, but with God, all things are possible. Only Yahweh can save. That's what he's remembering here. That's what he's calling to his mind. Abba, all things are possible for you, including salvation, including rescuing me. Save me. Now, you might wonder at this question because, as we've seen over and over again in Mark, all the Old Testament points to Jesus' death. Jesus is prophesied about his death. And so you look at this prayer and you're wondering, well, can the eternal decree of God be undone? Is that what Jesus is asking? Is Jesus asking God to forget his character and give forgiveness without a sacrifice? Is Jesus asking God to have mercy without justice? Is that what he's doing? And the answer, of course, is no. Jesus knows that God cannot do all things absolutely. All right, so if anyone asked the question, can God create a rock that he cannot lift? No, because then that rock would be God. That's not going to happen. God, for example, can't cease to be. He is being. That would be like hot ice or dry water or black whiteness. It just can't be. We also know that when it comes to his character, there are certain things that he cannot do. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 18 tells us that it is impossible for God to what? Lie, right? And James chapter 1 tells us impossible for God to be tempted or to tempt. So there are things that God cannot do, and because they would violate his character and his nature. And so Jesus isn't asking God to change any of that. That's not what he's doing. What he is saying is, I'm a human being. I'm very afraid. I know what the prophets say, and that's true. I know what your purpose is for me. That's true. I haven't quite worked out all the angles because I'm a limited human being. So within your character and nature, your promises and your purposes and your word, is there any way, Lord, Abba, Father, to save me from this hour? That's what he's asking. Now remember Satan's offer in the wilderness, the crown without the cross. Now you can know that that offer is still standing. For Jesus. You can have the crown without the cross. You can have the glory without the pain. That fruit that Satan offered Jesus in the wilderness and the fruit that Satan offered Adam and Eve in the garden is still here in this garden. Take, eat. Now, if you've read the Genesis account of the Garden of Eden, you'll notice that in that garden, Adam and Eve, during their temptation, never cried out for Yahweh. Have you noticed that? A talking snake comes up and says, here's some fruit. And they don't say, hey, God, can you help us out with this? But here, notice, from the beginning in this garden, Jesus has done nothing but cry out to his Father. That's all he's been doing since he got here. So why is he afraid? And we're told there in that verse, it's the cup. He's afraid of the cup. He doesn't want the cup. Turn to Jeremiah 25, verse 15, which is your first marker. There we read this. Take from my hand. God is talking to Jeremiah, the prophet, and he's saying to Jeremiah, take from my hand this cup of wine, of the wine of wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. Now, verses 17 through 26 list all the nations of the known world. And verse 29, at that time, and verse 29 indicates that the cup would be drained by everyone. You see that? So chapter 25 of Jeremiah is a declaration that all humanity stands under the wrath of God. Now, that might be difficult for you to take. God is love, but we learn here he is also wrath. The two must go together. When someone you love very deeply is violated, I hope that you feel wrath. It's the natural response. To do away with God's wrath is also to do away with his love. Now, human wrath is tinged with injustice and with pride and with malice, and so there's always some sin there. But God's wrath is pure, holy, and undefiled. And Jeremiah 25 says that, or displays God's wrath against all sinners. Why is he wrathful? Well, we understand that in the Trinitarian sense. He's wrathful because the Father is wrathful because the bride he chose for his Son is unfaithful. The Son is wrathful because his Father's creatures want to take down his Father. The Spirit is wrathful because humans glorify themselves with glory that belongs to only the Father and the Son. And so the Father, because he loves, and the Son, because he loves, and the Spirit, because he loves, also God as one has wrath. And so, again, verse 29, all must drink. But turn to your second marker, Isaiah 51, verses 22 through 23. All must drink this cup of wrath, but in Isaiah 51, verses 22 through 23, we see something else. Behold, God says there, he's speaking here to his people, those who believe in him. I've taken from your hand the cup of staggering. The bowl of my wrath you'll drink no more. And I'll put it into the hand of your tormentors. I'll take the cup of wrath from you. I'm going to give it to your tormentors. Okay, now turn to your third marker. In Revelation chapter 14, we're going rather fast, but it's all going to come together. And we see the cup again in Revelation 14, verses 9 through 11. If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark, he'll also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he'll be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. This will be forever, verse 11, forever and ever, and have no rest, day or night. It's a horrific, horrific scene. There are only two categories of person or people in Revelation, and indeed throughout all of Scripture. There are the first category of people, which are the followers of the beast. And in the second category, there are the followers of Christ, or in the Old Testament context, the followers of Yahweh. There's never any neutral ground. You either follow Christ or you follow the beast. Here in Revelation 14, God hands his cup of wrath, the cup that he took from his people, he gives it to their tormentors, those who have rejected his Son. Now, we might here have a problem because Jeremiah 25 implicates everyone in sin and says everyone deserves to drink the cup of God's wrath. Why is God taking it away from Jerusalem and from Israel and is only giving it to these people who don't follow his Son here in Revelation 14? Why? Well, I think the answer is in our next text, which is 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. There we read, for our sake, God, that's the he, made him, Jesus, to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. God becomes man. Jesus sees that on the cross, as the God-man, he is going to embrace and in fact become, not a sinner, but he is going to become sin. He is going to become, in Isaiah's language, the tormentor of God's people. And his Abba, his father, will give him the cup and he will drink it. The God-man became, or God became man to endure his own everlasting wrath for all who believe. So everybody has a choice. Every human being on the planet has a choice. Choice number one is take his cup, Jesus' cup, drink his blood, join yourself to him by faith, and he will then take your cup of wrath. Or the second choice is, of course, that you could drink that cup yourself. I hope you've chosen to take the Lord's cup. Notice, I think, that this is why Jesus trembles. No one has ever faced death as he does here. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you will never taste death in the way that Jesus is going to taste death. You're going to fall asleep as afraid you might be of death. You're going to fall asleep and you're going to wake up in your Lord's embrace, and you're going to rise again on the third day. It's going to be okay. Even if you refuse Jesus and you face eternal punishment, you're going to face eternal punishment for your sins only. Jesus here endures the cup of God's wrath for all who believe, for everyone who trusts him. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of hells is what he's facing. For a man who hates sin with all of his heart, mind, and soul, can you imagine the agony? For a man who's revulsed by sin, and for a man who loves as no one ever has, with all his heart, all his soul, all his strength, all his mind, he loves his Father, his Abba, who will, in a matter of hours, consider him to be his people's tormentor and punish him. That's what makes Jesus tremble in the garden. That's what makes him sweat blood. Now, the next words that we're going to read back in Mark 14 are the most important words in redemption history up to this point. Not what I will, but what you will. Not what I will, but what you will. This is Adam undone. This is Jesus saying, I will only eat the fruit my Father gives me, and no other. This is Jesus saying to his Abba, his Father, my life is yours. I trust you. I'm going to do as you say. I don't understand, but whatever you want, I will do, because I love you and I trust you. There is no, I want you to notice, no claiming here, no naming here. Jesus is not claiming anything in the Spirit. He's simply letting God have his way with him. It's the perfect prayer. The perfect prayer. Not what I will, but yours, but what you will. Verse 37, now he goes back. I don't know how long he's been away, but that's the substance of his prayer. That's the substance of his agony. And then he comes back in verse 37, and he found them sleeping. And he says to Peter, Simon, that's what he calls him. As John MacArthur says, Jesus calls Peter by his old name when he's acting like his old self. Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Now, Luke, in his account, tells us that they're weary with sorrow, as we said before. And I don't know if you've ever been as depressed as these guys probably are, but when you are, sleep is kind of an escape. You kind of want to go to sleep. You don't have to think about anything. I think that's where they are. They've seen Jesus fall down in fear and agony and bury his face in the ground and weep and sweat tears and sweat beads of blood. I mean, that's, they themselves are seeing their whole reality come undone. I don't know if you remember the first time you ever saw your dad cry. It was pretty devastating for me. My dad's always been kind of a strong guy. But when I saw him cry, when I saw weakness for the first time in him when I was a kid, it was kind of, wow, this is it. They see this in their Messiah. And so their whole world is kind of coming apart. And you might wonder then, why is Jesus castigating them? Well, because they vowed to die. They've said to him, we're going to drink the cup you drink. I will never betray you. I'll never deny you. I'll be with you forever, Jesus. They've made their boasts. And so Jesus wants to bring it to the forefront of their minds that their boasts have been empty. Why, Peter, James, John, you're sleeping. Why is that? You know what, guys? Give it another shot. There, verse 38. Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. Now, I want you to notice what he tells them to do. The only way he's saying to them that you're going to be able to do what I've just commanded you to do is if you do what? Pray. Lean on me. And then he goes on and says, the spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak. Let me translate that for you. You can't do what you want to do, and what you want to do, you cannot do. Does that sound familiar to you? Right. So we've all learned that lesson, I hope, in the walk through our Christian life. But guess what? These guys haven't learned that yet. Jesus is giving them new information. And so to help them get that point, he gives them a command, watch, which he knows they cannot fulfill. That's why God gives the law, or the first reason why God gives any law at all, because he wants to show proud, vain creatures they can't follow it. And when they can't follow it, the result hopefully will be that our boasting will fall silent, and then we will lean on and go to and depend on God and not ourselves. That's the point. And he's provided that remedy here when he says, pray. All right, guys. Verse 39. And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. There he goes. And again he came back and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. Even Peter didn't have something to say here. That's awesome. This is probably, after a number of different chapters, after several chapters, this is probably the first good thing that we've seen the disciples do in a long time. Silence. How do you answer? No excuses. Nothing. Well, you're right. I didn't stay awake. I thought I could. I mean, I told you I would. You said to, and you know, I'm Peter, so of course I should be able to. But why? I fell asleep. My goodness. What should this show me? And so, verse 41, Jesus says, all right, one more time. Verse 40, he goes away and he comes back again in verse 41. He came a third time and said to them, are you sleeping, taking your rest? Now, in Greek, that's not a question. It's a statement. It's like, sleep up. Take your rest. It's a little sarcasm. Jesus was sarcastic sometimes. Sleep up. Take your rest. They've seen, and here's the point I think he's making. These guys have seen Jesus broken, weeping, sweating blood. And now Jesus is saying, I think, Peter, who won't deny me three times, you've fallen asleep three times. Those two things should tell you something. I, your Lord, need my Father. You, Peter, fail over and over again. What do you think you ought to do? Jesus is not being mean when he's being sarcastic here. The fact is, these guys' world is coming down in hours, actually moments, from this little exchange here. And what Jesus wants and what Jesus knows they must do is they must embrace their weakness and their need for God before it comes down. Because if they don't, they'll be lost. And what's fascinating here is that in the midst of Jesus' own personal, agonizing, excruciating ordeal, he's taken the time to design an object lesson for his disciples. Isn't that amazing? He set this up. He knew they were going to mess up three times. He set it up to show them they needed God. He's a good shepherd to the last moment. And so he says, it's enough, the hour has come. And so he probably looks up there and he sees the crowd of temple soldiers and officials coming to arrest him. And when he sees that, and don't miss it, when he sees the crowd coming to arrest him, he has his father's answer. It's no. No. There's no other way. And so he says, verse 41, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. Now remember, they've separated themselves from the main group. So Jesus is not saying, hey, let's get out of Dodge. Let's leave. Let's get out of here. And he's not saying that. He's saying, let's go meet them. He will not let his sheep scatter, and he won't let them be destroyed. And so the obedient son goes to do his father's will. And we'll stop here and pray.